Welcome to the Long-Term Investing Podcast with Baskin Wealth Management. I'm Barry Schwartz, President and Chief Investment Officer. In this podcast, we ignore all the noise and have conversations about the things that matter in today's markets. It's what we talk about with each other here in the office, and we want to share those conversations with you. Please stay tuned for our legal disclaimer at the end of the episode. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm joined by Ernest as usual. Please remember to check out our presentation that we have completed on December 11th. We posted it on YouTube. We're going to share the links on our show notes as well. The title of the presentation is Conviction and Quality. The quick executive summary is we like to own quality companies. We're going to define what quality means. We review what's going on in the year, our defend our style, so to speak, and then talk about some examples of our style and companies that we like to own and focus more on the long term. 1 year performance, 1 year returns in the market. It can make you look smarter or dumb, but the focus obviously is to compound your returns over the very, very long term. And that's what our podcast and our investment style is all about. So before we get into the podcast, let's make sure that we always subscribe to our podcast on YouTube, on Spotify, and on Apple. We love all your comments, your feedback. I love your five-star reviews, of course. And if you're interested in a portfolio review and you want to speak to one of our portfolio managers, you want to come to our offices, check us out. We'd love to talk to you about investment management and our style and our approach. We've been managing individual and high net worth client money for well over 25 years. And we love what we do, and we're excited about 2026, Ernest.
Yes.
I'm very excited about our companies for 2026, right? So the good news is when some of your stocks don't go up and the fundamentals improve, maybe you can say the risk of owning them is actually a lot less now going forward because the market hasn't recognized their true value, their true potential.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of the lesson for this year where certainly we're lagging the broad indices quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's been a lot of reflection about are the companies that we're owning actually as good as we thought they were?
Yeah.
And I think if we look at just the numbers and, you know, there's going to be worries about the stock and the stock, other factors impacting the stock price. Mm-hmm. But if we look at the fundamentals of these companies, they're still growing. In many cases, like they have very strong balance sheets that they're using to repurchase shares at mm-hmm. cheaper prices. A lot of them are making acquisitions still and still thinking of creative ways to grow their business. And the valuations are a lot cheaper than they were at the beginning of the year.
That's right.
So I think that sets us very nicely up for good performance going forward.
That's right. And sometimes clients will ask, well, what's your favorite name in the portfolio? And I got to be honest with you, if we didn't like a company right now, we would get rid of it, right?
Right.
It's not like we sit on it waiting. We never fall for what's called the anchor bias. The anchor bias is, you know, you buy a stock for $20, it falls immediately to $12, and you're going to only sell it when it gets back to your price that you paid for it, the $20, right? But in the meantime, maybe it's only worth $12. Maybe it's only worth $10. Maybe the fundamentals have gone bad. Maybe things have changed with the industry. And so you constantly have to do those adjustments.
Right.
You know, investing is math, right? It's nice to talk about the qualitative and the stories, but it is math. And if the math doesn't make sense, you know, you have to get rid of the stock. We exited all the telcos earlier in 2024. Because the math wasn't mathing, so to speak. And so, you know, it's sometimes avoiding things can be very helpful to your portfolio when the math doesn't make sense. And so why did we get rid of the telcos? It was pretty simple, right? The free cash flow of those companies did not cover their dividends. And the growth of those companies was anemic, to say the best, right? So we kicked out Bell Canada out of the portfolio. We kicked out TELUS. These were not growth names anyways. These were names more for income plays. But the bottom line is if we don't like it and we see the fundamentals turning in the wrong way and we think that there's no hope for owning this company, we'll get rid of it.
So can I spend a second about the dividends on the telcos?
Yeah,
because I think this is something that is not commonly appreciated, where you saw, I think it's very easy for investors to kind of see TELUS trading at like a 9% dividend yield and say to myself, wow, I'm paying a lot for my TELUS bill. 9% dividend seems awesome.
Especially in an environment where bond yields and GIC yields are 3% or 2%.
Right.
Yeah.
But I think that if you really think about, we've talked about this kind of ad nauseum, but what dividends are a distribution of excess profits, mm-hmm. right? They're, if a company makes money and whatever they have left, they distribute it to shareholders and pay it out as a dividend. That's what dividends should be. It's not a bond-like interest payment or an obligation that the company should have to pay to shareholders on a recurring basis.
Yeah.
And so when you see a company like TELUS, where the dividend has exceeded free cash flow
mm-hmm.
for every year for the last 5 years, and the only way that they are able to fund this dividend is by using what is called a dividend reinvestment plan. And so what this is that shareholders can elect to convert their dividend payment into stock. Mm-hmm. And so for TELUS, what they do is that about a third, roughly, of their dividend payment is actually reinvested back into the company as equity.
So they don't actually have, so if they're paying out $100 million of cash flow, only $70 million is actually coming out of the bank and the rest is issuing new shares out of thin air.
Right. And so you can, and you can say, well, what's wrong with that?
Yeah.
And the problem with that is that if you are to actually get that 9% dividend yield, if you actually choose to get it in cash and goes into your bank account,
mm-hmm.
you're actually getting diluted.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you look at TELUS, their shares outstanding has increased by about 20% over the last 5 years.
Yeah.
So your share in TELUS is worth 20% less than what it was 5 years ago.
You get 20% less of those profits.
Yep, because of this dividend reinvestment scheme. And so
seems stupid.
No, and so I think
why do companies get caught in this trap?
And so I think that's one of those things where it's very easy to get to see a high dividend yield and to be attracted to it. But if you look at what's actually happening, maybe the picture is not as great as it seems.
Yeah.
And I think if especially for the telcos today, where if you look at the valuations that they trade at, the growth prospects that they have, which are certainly not as good as they've been for a while because immigration has slowed down.
Mm-hmm.
The competitive landscape, I think, has meaningfully changed with Quebecor being a large wireless player. And they still trade at similar or premium valuations to cable and wireless companies in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't see them, like, even though the share price is down, it just doesn't seem to be a hugely attractive bet to me.
Now, what about people that say, I need income? I'm retired. I can't put my money into GICs because A, they're not liquid, and B, it's fully taxable, and C, the income, the yield is pathetic.
Right.
Right. And so I need to own dividend stocks. And oh, great. The Canadian government gives me a little dividend tax credit on Canadian dividends paying companies. So that's a benefit for me. Dividends may be taxed at a more attractive rate than income. So people gravitate to these companies. But what do you do when you own a company like this that is clearly not covering their dividend? This is TELUS, and Bell cut its dividend. TELUS decided to halt its dividend growth.
Yes.
So what do you do when you own a stock like this?
I think there are plenty of companies out there mm-hmm. that are they're not yielding 9%, mm-hmm. but they are prudent dividend payers. They are paying dividends out of cash flow. They have solid, if not spectacular, growth prospects.
Yeah.
And they you can probably yield like 4%, 5%, 6% in a tax-advantaged way. And so I'm thinking of companies like, let's say, Pembina Pipeline, right? It's a infrastructure provider. They own natural gas processing infrastructure. It's largely a recurring business that they offer to the energy industry. And they have a good pipeline of projects to grow profits, yep, and cash flows and the dividend.
Yep. So, but even so, those pipelines, those midstreams, we remember during COVID when, yep, the price of oil dropped and no one was driving, or the price of oil went negative and people were, right, concerned, like Pembina's pipeline stock, I think, fell in half because people were concerned that, well, if we're not moving any oil, then their pipelines and their assets are useless, right? So we're getting off tangent, but the bottom line is there's no safe company. You have to diversify, right? And you have to accept maybe lower yields to get better durability. You and I own a private company called Baskin, yes, Financial Services. If we have a bad year,
yeah,
really bad year, we're losing clients, bad performance, something bad happens in the market, I'm not going to borrow money to pay dividends to shareholders of Baskin, right? We're just not going to do it.
Right.
We'll just reduce our dividend.
Yes.
And hopefully next year will be better. Why can't companies follow that same type of approach, public companies, where they say, okay, it's a good year, let's pay out more dividends. It's a bad year, let's reduce it.
And there are companies that do that.
Yeah.
Like, for example, I'm thinking Tourmaline Oil,
yeah,
where they have a base dividend, but it's relatively modest, and they recognize that natural gas prices are volatile and, mm-hmm, that they want more flexibility to be able to maintain their cash flow. And so they pay a special dividend that is higher when gas prices are higher and lower when gas prices are low. And to me, that seems like a very prudent way to manage the dividend.
I think that's the right approach. But obviously, when you cut your dividend, there's exchange-traded funds that, yes, may not want to own your stock anymore. There's specific investors. Everybody knows when a company cuts its dividend, it's not a great signal. And so these types of things happen when you're dealing with, finance should be dynamic. It shouldn't be static. And, we're looking to own companies that can grow their top line. The most important thing, of course, is the ability to grow, right? If you're a business where your top line isn't growing, I don't know if you can cut your way to a successful dividend growth strategy if the top line isn't growing. And that's really the problem with the telcos right now, is the top lines are growing less than GDP and inflation, which is a problem.
Yes.
So our feature discussion today is going to be about Netflix. You might have seen Netflix making a bid for Time Warner's assets as well as Paramount, what that all means. Of course, the market didn't really like this deal for Netflix. Ernest has a different opinion, but this has been a year for our clients where a couple of our companies have tried to make these splashy big acquisitions. I'm thinking about Couche-Tard as well.
Yeah.
And the market just hates on them and punishes their stock. It has nothing really to do with whether the company's being run well, Netflix or Couche-Tard or not. It's worries about the uncertainty of the future and how that plays out, and we'll get into that. And we also want to discuss the Canadian banks, Canadian bank stocks, all at all-time highs or close to it, and maybe a few other things if we can get around to it. So Ernest, Netflix, you've done a lot of thinking. You tweeted a long thread about your thoughts, and I think we'll link it to the show notes too so people can check out. It's dynamic, right? Netflix came out with its bid. Paramount, they won the deal to acquire Warner Brothers, and then of course Paramount is taking their deal to shareholders with a higher offer. It's uncertain if this will ever close. You've got Trump, and it's an amazing story. You got politics, you got nepotism, you got billionaires.
I think they're going to make an HBO show on this.
It's called Succession, right?
Yes.
you've got the big evil company Netflix. You've got it's just fascinating story. I'd love to read the book one day. All these discussions, but this is what's going on right now. The bottom line is Netflix trying to acquire Warner Brothers for $70+ billion, and its stock has fallen about 15% since it signed this. Was it a letter of intent or
no? There's a deal.
There's a full deal.
They signed a deal.
They signed a deal. Okay.
I think for Couche-Tard and for Netflix now, I think there's a little bit where goes back to our discussion that we just had about the dividends and the telcos, which is that the investor base often gets to understand and they like predictability. They like it when a company is doing kind of following a safe, comfortable way that they've always been operating. And so when Netflix, you know, they've been gaining share in streaming, they've been, you know, kind of historically been not an acquisitive company, largely growing their business organically.
Well, let's just stop right there for a second. Like, think about the history of Netflix. It started out as a company sending out DVDs by mail.
Yes.
Right? And now it's become the largest media company in the world.
Right.
An incredible story.
Well, Netflix would say they're far from...
But yes. Yeah. So it just goes back to, A, it's all about management, and B, it's all about, can the future be better than it was in the past, right? And Netflix pivoted. It became a content provider, became a media company. It's grown so dramatically. This was a company where people thought it was going to go bankrupt.
Yes.
I remember people calling it Debtflix.
Yep.
And, you know, in the last few years, it's generating so much free cash flow that it's an actively buying back stock. You know, Netflix is a growth company. And it probably shouldn't be buying back stock. It should be putting that cash to work in better ideas, because it's buying back its stock at a high valuation. So here's the opportunities that it has ahead of itself. It's facing companies like Disney and Paramount and Comcast, who are suffering. And this is the time to pounce. So I don't know why anybody would be upset at Netflix trying to make this deal.
No, and I think specifically what people are and the market investors are worried about is that if you look at the history of media mergers, it's largely a battle of egos. It's people wanting to grow their business, wanting to not lose just because of the presence that they would have in media.
You have big personalities, right?
Yes.
The Sumner Redstones at Paramount, the Eisners at Disney. Yeah. You have all these people who, Barry Diller, and they're all, I guess they think they're the greatest in the world.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so the history of large media mergers, and certainly for Warner Brothers, has not been great. And so I think the inevitable thought that a lot of people have when Netflix makes such a move is, well, are they, you know, losing their discipline that they've historically had? And Ted Sarandos is really just after the name recognition in Hollywood.
Ted Sarandos being the co-CEO of Netflix.
Yes.
So let's break down first Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers is a media conglomerate that owns cable assets as well as a streaming business. Everybody knows HBO, The Sopranos, and The Wire, Game of Thrones, all those great, and also has a number of intellectual property content that it makes movies with, right?
Yep.
Batman and Harry Potter, DC. So great, great content right up there with Disney. Does Warner Brothers also own theater parks?
No parks. Although,
they don't own any parks. They license their technology. Yes.
So that's what Warner today is. Basically, they have the studio business, which makes money from selling, making movies, showing them in theaters, and licensing the shows out to third parties, including Netflix.
Yeah.
And then they also have a streaming business today, which is HBO Max, as well as a cable business, which includes CNN, right? And so,
and a number of other cable products that people know, like Home and Garden TV, Discovery type,
and
Shark
so
Week.
Netflix's proposal is to acquire the studio, Warner Brothers Studio, HBO, and HBO Max. Mm-hmm. So, what most people consider to be the good stuff, right? They're not buying the cable networks business, which is going to be, under Netflix's proposal, going to be spun out as an independent company. And so I think before we get into my hypothesis on the Netflix's rationale, there's going to be a lot of commentary about kind of the societal impacts, whether it's impacting the livelihood of Hollywood and all those kinds of things. And I'm not saying those things are not. I think we're financial analysts.
Yeah.
Our job is to make money.
Yeah.
And so
not to commiserate or reminisce about right. how the old ways used to be and exactly. how good they were. Yeah.
And not yeah. to say that we don't care about those things, yeah. but they're just not relevant from an investment perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think that Netflix here, the reason that they are doing this deal, I think is 100% financially motivated. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think a lot of the commentary is out there suggesting that Netflix wants to shut down HBO Max. They want to just port all the content into Netflix and you know, just kind of build scale and grow the business without really regarding cost of what they're acquiring.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a very, very shrewd deal. Mm-hmm. And this is what I think Netflix is
You seem
after.
To be the only one because the stock market completely disagrees with the Netflix offer.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So I think that what Netflix is after, and this has been very consistent from what the management has said, as well as what other mm-hmm. industry observers have said. I think that what Netflix is trying to do is not to take Game of Thrones and DC and all those things and shove them into Netflix. Mm-hmm. I think it wouldn't make any sense for them to do that because they're already licensing HBO shows, mm-hmm. a lot of them, for Netflix. Mm-hmm. I think what they're trying to do is that if you look at the problems of HBO Max over the last, ever since they launched the business, they were unable to scale it up as a successful streaming service compared to Netflix. And the reason for that is because they were often, they're a smaller player, first of all. They had a lot of debt that resulted from the purchase of Time Warner all those years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And they were just late to the party in that they didn't, people were already subscribing to other streaming services. And so what HBO Max had to do was to drive growth by bundling together with other streaming services or to sign deals with cable companies and other distributors such as Roku.
Yeah. Canadians will know that, of course. You can't subscribe to HBO Max.
Right.
The streaming business directly. You can subscribe to what's called Crave, that's right. owned by Bell Canada, where they license the shows
yes.
to, and I guess they both split the subscriber fee, so to speak.
Yes.
Yeah.
And so,
which is not if, as good as Netflix taking 100% of the subscriber right. fee.
And so yeah. HBO Max, that's been an ongoing issue for HBO Max, mm-hmm. which is that the amount of money that they're receiving for their, from subscribers is far less than what the ticket price or the subscription price is for HBO Max.
Or what Netflix is
earning.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think Netflix's strategy here is that they recognize that Netflix has all the subscribers already.
Mm-hmm.
They can acquire HBO Max and wean off HBO Max off of these distributor contracts.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of taking all of HBO Max's content, shutting it down and moving it into Netflix, can create a standalone streaming service that has very good content that people want to watch,
mm-hmm.
and use the Netflix platform to drive subscriber growth of HBO Max.
Okay.
And so the way that they would do that is by, they can sign they can create bundling and pricing offers together with Netflix that you sign up mm-hmm. through your Netflix subscription. They can promote Game of Thrones or HBO Max content within the Netflix app that people are already watching. And so that they have all these, they can add a more successful ad-supported tier for HBO Max.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's all these different ways that Netflix can grow HBO Max as a standalone streaming service mm-hmm. that just aren't available to anybody else.
And the reason why is because Netflix has the distribution.
Exactly.
And the leverage over
right.
The cable subscribers.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so I think that is the opportunity that Netflix sees with the Warner assets mm-hmm. and why Ted Sarandos, the CEO, has continued to insist that he's not going to shut down. He's not going to pull movies from the theaters. Mm-hmm. He's going to continue to license out content for that they make to third parties, and that he will maintain HBO Max as a standalone streaming service.
Yeah, I don't see why movies and Netflix can't coexist.
Right.
Right. Especially if you have a theatrical window of a few weeks, or I mean, some movies are meant to be seen on the big screen, yep. right? Whether they're filmed in using special technology or better sound. You know, I get it. My kids watch movies on their phones, but, you know, it's nice to go to a movie once yeah. in a while. And if the quality movies are good, then the box office will do well. And Netflix will make a ton of money off movies also.
And if you do the math on what Netflix can do to raise, you know, mm-hmm. just to raise the pricing of HBO Max that HBO Max gets without having to pay the distributor share, mm-hmm. the math becomes very interesting for Netflix very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. I think that's really the opportunity that they see to acquire this asset.
And so the metric, what is this called? Average revenue per user?
Yes.
The ARPU.
Yeah, ARPU.
Yeah, and so the ARPU at Netflix is pretty decent yeah. and the ARPU at Time Warner.
Yeah, so the average revenue per streaming yeah. subscriber at HBO is, I think, something like $8.
Yeah.
And something like $2 or $3 internationally.
Yeah.
And that's because of these contracts that they're stuck with. Mm-hmm. Whereas under Netflix, they have to wait for these agreements to expire, but it'll be a lot closer to the price that subscribers have to pay for HBO Max, which is probably something like, I think, $15 to $20 in the US mm-hmm. or $9, $10 even in international markets.
And presumably this could be good for consumers, right? They'll have more access to HBO shows.
Yeah.
They may be cheaper for them to have the bundle of Netflix and HBO than pay for them separately. Also, you will have a bigger company that can produce better content. And as well, we haven't even talked about there's video game opportunities yep. with licensing Harry Potter and Batman and DC type stuff. You name yep. it, right? So there's some great crossover opportunities. This is what Netflix is trying to do. It's going to become the most dominant media company in the world. It competes obviously against anybody who watches, Google and YouTube and looks at Meta and TikTok and Discord. You can claim that there's billions of people online that still could be accessing Netflix content instead of watching AI slop videos on YouTube.
Now, to be clear, like there's no Netflix has not confirmed, like it's not a done deal.
Yes.
Like it still has to go through an antitrust process. I think Paramount is still out there with a hostile offer to acquire the company. Mm-hmm. And so it's far from tomorrow you're going to start seeing
yeah, we have no
HBO
idea.
Shows on yeah. Netflix.
It could take 18 to 24 months. Netflix could drop out at some point, say it's not worth their effort.
Yep.
Paramount could win the day. Netflix would get a few billion dollars of a breakup fee, which is, it's not nothing. But the way we see it is it's a win-win for Netflix.
Right.
Either they get these assets now or Paramount blows its brains out trying to acquire, Time Warner. It's not like Paramount is doing great.
No.
So you're going to merge the fifth biggest streamer and the fourth biggest streamer. And I don't think there's going to be many synergies or opportunities for them, right? We have to remember the number one streamer is Netflix. Then you got Amazon and Disney, yeah.
Yeah.
And so there's too many streamers. It makes sense for the content to be under Netflix, but we'll see what happens. In the meantime, if Paramount does end up spending way more money than Netflix, they're going to have to somehow come up with money to pay down that debt. They might want to start licensing all their good shows to Netflix anyways.
Right. And to that point,
yeah.
I kind of want Netflix to just let Paramount take Warner.
Yeah.
Because Netflix gets $2.8 billion. And probably in all likelihood, they're still going to end up getting the HBO shows when because from a third party licensing agreement.
That's right. We'll see what happens. In the meantime, Netflix itself, ignoring the potential acquisition last quarter, like strong growth. Here's your chance to buy us one of the best businesses in the world, which has amazing leverage in, yeah. As it adds new subscribers, gushing free cash flow right now. Valuation has come down a whole heck of a lot. We think the earnings are going to double over a 3-ish year period. There's still more.
Right, even before
any Time Warner, yeah. I keep calling it Time Warner, but it's Warner Brothers, yes. WBD. The bottom line is, we like the company very, very much and happy to continue to buy more and wait this out. Is Netflix going to be a dead stock for 6 to 12 months while this regulatory stuff goes on? Maybe, but that's not important. And what's important is we're going to be watching the fundamentals of Netflix. If they keep adding more subscribers, if they keep raising prices, if they keep doing all the right things, then the valuation becomes too good to be true.
Yeah, I think generally, like I think the market investors are correct to generally be skeptical of mm-hmm. large acquisitions.
Yes,
but I think with Netflix and with Couche-Tard and with others in our portfolio like TFI
yeah.
that have done large mergers in the past, I think in the end of the day, it really comes down to the management and whether you trust that they know what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I really do think that they've spent a lot of time thinking about it and really think that it's going to be a very profitable deal for Netflix.
Netflix has proven operators. They've proven to the street that they can grow their subscribers, that they can grow their profits, that they can grow their free cash flow, that they know how to run a media business. And obviously you can see by the market cap, Time Warner Brothers hasn't proven that out yet. And I don't think very many streamers are making any money really on streaming. Is Disney making money a little bit?
Barely.
Right.
And not growing subscribers
No. Well, it's like the same old, Marvel content. It gets boring after a while, right? So okay, so that's our take on Netflix. We'll see what happens. What are we doing with the stock as it's had volatility? Same thing as like Couche-Tard. We ignore the day-to-day noise on it. We think we've done the math on it. We think it would be a good deal if Netflix acquires it. If it doesn't, we still think Netflix is a great, well-run business, and we're happy to continue to buy more of that company.
Right.
So let's quickly pivot to the Canadian banks.
Yep.
Very interesting, Ernest. Canadian banks are all trading at all-time highs. This has been a crazy year. So if you think about it, and someone just posted like, okay, you had all these tariffs, you had all these worries. Like a stock like General Motors is up 50% this year.
Right.
The Canadian banks are up, some of them are up 25 to 30 to 40%. People were so worried the Canadian economy was going to get killed because of the tariffs and the uncertainty. Canadian stock market is killing it. So it just goes to show you that even if you knew bad news was coming and so much uncertainty, it may or may not matter. I mean, it matters in the short term, but ultimately why the Canadian bank stocks are up is because their earnings have been fantastic, right? And way better than expected, especially considering that it's not like the Canadian economy is in a fast growth mode, although, the last few quarters have shown decent growth. And so focus on the fundamentals is always proves out.
Yeah, and I think that the strong performance of the Canadian banks this year is really, really reflective of the business model that they have, which I think the average Canadian, if I walked out onto the street, mm-hmm. probably doesn't appreciate to this extent, where the Canadian banks are large, diversified prime lenders to prime borrowers. And so the main reason why their earnings are growing so fast is because they have large wealth management businesses and large capital markets businesses, which are things like investment banking, where those two businesses are benefiting tremendously because the stock market is good. Mm-hmm. Because when the stock market goes up, the wealth management fees go up, as we know, and companies want to raise more capital by doing investment banking, mm-hmm. and raising debt and raising yeah. equity for deals Warner Brothers. Yeah. So that's. Those are the income streams that have really powered the earnings growth of the Canadian banks this year.
And when you put your money in the bank or you buy a GIC or you have a mortgage, I mean, you're giving the bank free money.
Yeah.
As long as you don't default.
GICs are not free
money. No, yeah. But you're giving the bank free money if you leave a cash balance in your account. And they're going to use that money to reinvest into their business by making acquisitions, buying back stock, building out their loan book, their wealth management plans. And when interest rates are so low and the economy is doing fine, nobody's defaulting, this is actually Goldilocks for the Canadian banks. So there shouldn't be any surprise why the Canadian banks are doing great. We have a nice size position in National Bank, owned it for quite a long time. We also have an allocation to Royal Bank. We sold TD Bank earlier this year because of last year because of some shenanigans. Probably should have held on to it given the, but you know, the banks kind of all trade in the same range, right? Unless one really screws up.
Right. And I think that's the thing where I think people might be confused. Well, the Canadian economy is so sluggish. So how can the Canadian banks be doing so well? And that goes to the fact that if you look at their banking business, which is the ones that actually take the deposits and lend out mortgages and credit cards and those kinds of things, they really, really only focus on high-end borrowers. So these are people that have good-paying jobs, that have a good track record of repaying their debts and leaving the subprime, so the less credit-worthy borrowers to alternative lenders. So that might be non-big six banks, or increasingly to the alternative market where private funds are funding mortgages and products for those types of borrowers. And so what we're seeing is that the Canadian banks, because they focus on good borrowers, I think they're largely fine despite the kind of sluggishness in the economy. Mm-hmm. I think credit cards are like losses on credit cards are starting to tick up a little bit because these are unsecured debt.
Right? But on the other hand, inflation means that the price of buying everything is gone up.
Right.
So the credit cards are making more money versus the losses. Yeah. Yeah.
And I think the general tone is that they want to remain cautious going forward because there's still worries about tariffs. There's still worries about I think the mortgage renewals coming in 2026, which are, even though rates have come down, they're still stepping up. Borrowers are still going to have to pay more.
I heard someone said, they're going to raise rates this year. I there's no chance of that because there's still mortgages coming due where people got them 4 or 5 years ago, 1 or 2%. And the good news is for some fixed mortgages, I think some of them are now below 4%.
Right.
Because
but still renewing higher because they were written when rates were
much
zero.
Lower, yeah.
Right.
Exactly. And of course, the cost of living has gone up. People's wages may have not accommodated. The housing market could be tough. So there's still issues. And we all know the condo market is very scary right now. Some real estate development projects are not happening. There could be some things on the hook for the banks. So we'll see.
And I think put together what we are seeing is from what one bank described as a K-shaped economy, where richer people who have money in the stock market and own houses and investments are benefiting from the strong stock market, and whereas those who are primarily renters who earn less, they're really facing the pinch from inflation, and they're the ones where you're seeing higher default rates, which I think I'm not going to name anyone, but if you look at the results for some of the alternative lenders, I think you can really see that starting to pop up in the results.
But as you said, the Canadian banks don't have much exposure to that.
Right.
And so they're exposed to, I mean, it's kind of like owning the you're owning the quality clients.
Yes.
And so kudos to the Canadian banks. Kudos to those that recognize that, that stuck with the Canadian banks. We talked about it, all the worries that potentially were going to happen with the Canadian banks as we headed into 2025. Really, none of them materialized.
Right. And so I think kind of the natural question is, where do we see the Canadian banks going in 2026?
Yes. So a lot of it obviously hinges on strength in stock markets.
Right. Yes. It gives and takes away.
Right. Yeah. So the Canadian stock market is up, a lot this year. Is it all hot air? Is it all gold? Does it make sense? It's impossible to know, but right. Obviously the vibes of strong stock markets can lead to the wealth effect, can lead to people spending more money, more IPOs, more secondary offerings, more people investing. As interest rates go down, all right, I'm not going to invest in a 2% GIC. I got to put it in the stock market.
Yep.
Hopefully you don't buy TELUS stock at 9% yield, but you get the point, right? And so the banks have a good scenario, but anything can happen.
Right. And I think that's kind of the picture for the Canadian banks, where I think that to have successfully predicted the year that they would have had this year means you basically were making a market call that the stock market was going to go up.
Yeah.
Right. And so I think they still have strong business models.
Yeah. But the earnings have proven out, right? So, but obviously you could say some of those earnings are tied to market beta.
For names like National Bank, we think that they still have a lot of opportunities in integrating the acquisitions that they've done. The Canadian Western Bank deal, and they just acquired a little portfolio from Laurentian as well.
Yeah.
So I think that we're not selling it.
No.
And so
I think that you're going to see the Canadian banks be quite acquisitive going forward,
and especially given their balance sheets.
Yeah, and especially in the wealth management and the fee space, right?
Yes.
Reduce its reliance on deposits and mortgages, which, that's an up and down business, and more on fees. And so kudos to the banks for doing that. And stocks are at all time high. The valuations, of course, are high as well. So
they've gone higher.
Yeah. So take a bet on the banks today, obviously you have to hope that things are stable going forward, because you are buying them at the highest valuations in a while.
So there is one thing that I think people are not thinking about, which is, and people often say this as a buzzword, but I think AI is a real opportunity for the Canadian banks.
Yeah, good point.
Because I used to work at CIBC. Like, that was my very first job. And my brother also worked at a bank before. These are some of the most outdated legacy systems that you'll probably see anywhere outside of the government, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a real issue, because like when I was at CIBC, the server would go out like once a week and we would not be able to meet our client deadline because of technology.
But this was a long time ago.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and they've made probably made some progress on that.
Yeah.
But I think the opportunity for AI is that the Canadian banks can use AI to really modernize their infrastructure, which is one of the use cases that the big techs have been talking about for AI, because it can go in and automatically rewrite code and do those kinds of upgrades very, very easily.
Very exciting.
So I think that the Canadian banks have large opportunity to be able to improve their technology platform, upgrade their tech stacks, reduce what we call tech debt, and we'll see a more reliable infrastructure and lower cost.
Have we seen the Canadian banks start talking aggressively about AI and implementing it?
Yeah, I think TD had an investor day where they spent a long time talking about using AI. Mm-hmm. Royal, I think they said they were going to use AI, which is a meaningful driver of lower expenses going forward. Well, and I think a lot of people read that and they say, well, they're just going to fire a bunch of people. But I don't think that's what they mean.
Yeah.
It's that they're able to use AI to improve the efficiency of all the technology that they're using and to just make things a lot more streamlined.
Amazing opportunities for a lot of companies as a result of AI. It's going to be very fascinating as AI keeps getting implemented. We're not going to talk about AI on this conversation. We're going to do one more episode next week. That will be our year-end wrap. We'll talk about highlights and the lowlights of the year for our companies and things that we're very excited about as we head into 2026. Even though some of our companies' stock performance may not have lived up to expectations, a lot of our companies have taken interesting steps in these times of uncertainty to improve their balance sheets, to fix their, use AI, what have you, to really set up things nicely for going forward. And so we're going to share some examples and talk about where we're seeing a lot of opportunity for 2026. So with that, we'll see you back here real soon. Thank you very much for joining us. This podcast is for informational purposes only. And any forecasts on the economy, markets, or individual securities should not be viewed as investment advice, a recommendation or an offer or solicitation to buy or sell any securities. Clients of Baskin Wealth Management and the speakers on this podcast may own shares of the companies discussed. Information on this podcast is current as of the time of production and is subject to change. If you have any questions or would like to subscribe to these podcasts, visit our website at baskinwealth.com.